question that I've often thought about. If each religion claims that what it teaches is true and that the way to salvation is through its teaching, then why aren't there more broad-scale attempts at conversion? Is it possible to religiously justify a group such as ISIS, who may say they are trying to convert people to their religion for their salvation? Now, I appreciate there are many other issues at play with the ISIS thing, and there are groups of people that do their utmost to convert people to their religious worldview. But at a general level, why is there not more attempts at conversion that goes on? Working through this question is one of the meta topics that I'm exploring as part of this program. But in this episode, we are grasping the nettle and looking at it directly. And we are doing so with the esteemed assistance of Father Michael Barnes. Father Michael is a Jesuit, a former professor of interreligious relations at Heythrop College in London, was the director of the Denobly Dialogue Centre, which focused on interfaith communication, and served as a consultant to the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue in Rome and to the Ecumenical Church's Commission on Interfaith Relations. His expertise is on the Eastern faiths of Hinduism and Buddhism, and it's safe to say he is a preeminent voice in the area of interreligious dialogue. I posed Father Michael this question, and in the ensuing conversation, we don't just talk about the importance of space and respect when it comes to interreligious dialogue, but also how we can come to a deeper understanding of our own faith when we listen and consider the point of view of the other. Ultimately, he puts forward a very strong case that heavy attempts at conversion are fundamentally antithetical to a loving religious practice. Father Michael has also written several books whose titles include Theology and the Dialogue of Religions, Waiting on Grace, Interreligious Learning, and Ignatian Spirituality and Interreligious Dialogue. So if you're interested in the conversation that follows, I really recommend going, finding those books, and giving them a read. Now, to those people that have been patiently waiting for our episode, continuing to look at the Egyptian Copts and my trip to the monastery just north of Cairo, I'm sorry, but as that episode is going to be in video format, a format that I haven't done before, it's taking a little bit more time, and that alongside a newborn baby isn't really a match made in heaven. So I ask for your forgiveness until it comes, but it is coming. You'll have to keep waiting patiently. So for now, we are continuing with our more standard format with this conversation on interreligious dialogue. And I thank you all for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. Father Michael Barnes, thank you very much for having me in here in Mayfair. Took a bit of a walk around this morning. Beautiful, beautiful spot. The church next door. What's the name of the church specifically?
Church of the Immaculate Conception.
Church of the Immaculate Conception. Yeah. On Farm Street.
Yeah. Farm Street's the street at the back.
At the back.
This end is Mount Street. It's very confusing. The church is between the two roads.
To the two. And so it acts as a bit of a thoroughfare.
So the main entrance is actually on Farm Street.
Yep.
And the back entrance is on Mount Street.
Right. That's not confusing.
It is. Well.
but that was beautiful. But here, I've come to talk to you about sort of interreligious dialogue. Mm-hmm. And I thought we'd dive in at sort of the deep end with this topic. And start with the idea of sort of considering that all religions or religions posit themselves or propound, they hold the truth. What space is there for interreligious dialogue apart from simply trying to convert other people?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Well, that's a good question. Let me just try and frame it a little bit in the way I would want to deal with the issue of interreligious dialogue. Because I begin with a practical question. And the practical question has got something to do with different traditions, orthodox traditions, seeking and finding space for themselves, but also space for each other. And I think the issue which arises for persons of faith, and I prefer to use that idea, persons of faith rather than traditions as such or religions as such, which is a little bit abstract. Let's focus it on the people. The persons of faith in today's world, especially in the West, where you have so many religions living up against each other, is how do you deal with pluralism? How do you give space for the others to be themselves alongside your own commitment to an orthodox version of your tradition, of your belief. Okay. And the way I always begin is to think of it this way, that it isn't a matter of comparable sets of beliefs, religious traditions, which can be put up against each other. Okay. It's not as if you've got lots and lots of comparable answers, which can be regarded as more truthful, less truthful, or whatever. People begin with questions, which questions they ask about themselves and their own world, and therefore begin from different perspectives with different questions, which may come out of their own history, which may come out of traditions which are very much built up against the background of certain traumas of history. So you can't say, for example, that Jews have the same perspective on world history as Christians do or Muslims do. They all come from different histories, which mean that the questions they're asking are quite precise, sometimes quite focused, other times rather more general. Okay. Those questions mean that it is quite difficult, I think, and not very helpful to see religions as different answers to the same question. Rather, there are different questions which bring different answers. So that's saying something about, you know, religious pluralism itself. Okay. And the little image I always use for this is when you're talking about the encounter of religions or the dialogue of religions, or you're talking about more specifically how people learn to get on with each other, okay, we're not really talking about different entities, different products, different things which can be put together as you would put the oranges and the apples and the God knows what else in the supermarket. You know? This is not a helpful way to begin. So a different way of looking at the pluralism of religions that we encounter is not so much the supermarket, but the school. And in the school, what you've got are people learning and teaching. So you're taking the wisdom, the questions, the history of a particular tradition, and you're bringing it into the present. And what the great teachers are always doing to their students is trying to encourage them to understand the world through the prism of this this particular tradition. So following that one through, it always seems to me that what the dialogue of religions is doing is trying to bring one school into some sort of a contact or encounter with another school where the same sort of things are going on. Obviously, a Catholic school will teach things from a Catholic perspective. An Islamic school, a Muslim school, will teach things from a Muslim perspective. And they will keep alive and seek to instruct their children in these traditions. So we're talking here about something which is actually living. And it's living insofar as the different communities of faith, not just keeping alive the memory of the past, but they're trying to bring that memory into a correlation with what's going on today. So religions at once are ancient traditions, and they're at the same time trying to engage with a world which is sometimes really quite complicated. Sometimes they do that extremely well, and they become more focused on how you adapt what you're teaching to contemporary questions. Sometimes they'll do it badly, and you get that sort of fundamentalism which, you know, tends to retreat into the background almost. What is interreligious dialogue doing? It's enabling that process of encounter to take place. And the model I always use is hospitality. Now, can a tradition be hospitable to other ideas, other schools, what other people are teaching. And to do that, you need to learn how to be a host, and you need to learn how to be a guest. Sometimes you're enabling something to happen by welcoming others into your space, and sometimes you're in their space, and you have to learn a sort of, you know, a way of behavior, a procedure which is respectful of what you find there. So sometimes you're teaching, sometimes you're learning. Okay, what's this all got to do with, you know, the question which you're asking? Well, I think the key question is actually space. You know, can we find space for each other? Can we find space where I can be responsibly myself and allow the other to be responsibly themselves? And then we work out some sort of way of talking to each other. That I always think of as the conversation model for interreligious dialogue, where the schools are talking to each other, where in some ways what's at stake is not the integrity of truth as such, but the questions which arise when people start talking about truth responsibly before each other, where the what's at stake is, can I communicate this? Can I communicate this in a way which makes sense to these people, while at the same time being recognized within my community of faith as something which is orthodox? Space and time, you know, the two go together. How can we find space for each other? How can we find time for each other? It's not that truth somehow vaguely emerges in the course of a conversation. Rather, one learns to appreciate the language which people use when they are seeking to speak truth to each other. That means taking time just to listen to what's going on. So that by way of introduction to what you're saying.
Yeah. And why should we do this? Why should we engage in interreligious dialogue to begin with? Why is it not just, okay, I am a Christian, I'm happy in my religious beliefs, and I don't need to engage in any with other religious believers in the community?
Well, I think there's a couple of answers to that. One is that most religious traditions do have something which they feel is important for them to say to others, okay, for all sorts of reasons. You've got three religions in the world which are strictly world religions because they're not tied to one particular part of the world where they have developed. You know, Hinduism would be an example of that, very much an Indian religious tradition. But even Hinduism has got something to say on a world stage. The more so now, where you're getting types of Hindu nationalism coming into play. But Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam are regarded normally as the world religions, because they don't see themselves as simply concerned with maintaining a tradition apart. Okay, they have something to say. Christianity clearly is a missionary religion. Islam has got its dawah. You know, you're always witnessing to the truth. If you go into a mosque, you'll always find somebody coming up to you, not to say, oh, I'm going to tell you the truth of Islam, but they're welcoming you.
Yeah.
And they bring you in, and you want to talk about something serious. And that's dawah. It's witness to the truth. Buddhism is a religion which has developed over hundreds of years, thousands of years, and it's adapted itself as the tradition has moved from one place to another. So you get all sorts of forms of Buddhism. In fact, there really isn't a Buddhism. There's a Buddhist orthodoxy right behind that. But it's true to say that the Buddhism you'll find in the West is markedly different from what you find in, say, Sri Lanka, which is a very traditional background against which the religion is taught. But nevertheless, the Buddha produces a way of thinking, a way of being, which has got something to say. It's a universal truth. There is a universal truth behind Buddhism as much as there is behind Islam and Christianity. The other point I would want to make very simply is more and more we're concerned in our world today about how different perspectives on truth, on being, on all sorts of political and ethical questions, how these are to be played out. And it's no longer the case that you can simply leave religion, spirituality, as something which is very much a private, personal commitment. So many people these days are saying, well, no, I am religious because I believe in this, I believe it's important, I believe it's important for me, but it's also important for the world in which I live. So there's an ethical question there about what is religious belief for. Is it just for me and my salvation? Or is it saying something which really does have an importance and a relevance for everybody? These are public, in other words, traditions. More and more is that the case.
Diving slightly into the weeds a little bit, how, and just to pull an example, how would a Muslim and a Christian talk with one person saying that Jesus is the Son of God, and the other person saying that the Quran is the revealed word of God? They both don't believe those same things. Is there anything beneficial to be talking about that sort of thing? Or is that... How can dialogue exist with those sorts of clashes? Or is it just, as you sort of mentioned, a matter of space and sort of agreeing to disagree?
Well, I think that last point is a fair one. Do we agree to disagree, or do we disagree about our agreements, or whatever, whatever? You know, I do think that for any religious tradition, learning is important, and it is an interesting experience that people have when they're actually talking to each other. In some ways, agreeing to disagree and appearing to be at cross purposes and thinking, you know, well, I don't believe that. And I think that's quite wrong. And one coming back said, well, you haven't actually understood quite what I'm talking about here. It is interesting how you do begin to sort of deepen your appreciation of the disagreements, you know, where the real differences lie. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not as if you come out saying, oh, now I understand totally. You don't. I often find you have this experience of the goalposts getting moved. You know, when you're saying to a Muslim, for example, so what you're saying is that Jesus is a prophet of Islam, but the language which we use is completely wrong, or something like that. Mm. And the guy listens to what I'm saying and says, well, yes and no. And that's usually what happens. And that's when the goalposts start moving. And you begin to realize you're talking about something a little bit different. You know, there's a sort of subtlety that gets into it. It's in many ways, it's unpredictable how this sort of process can go on. And it's the case not just that, you know, if I'm talking to my Muslim friend or my Buddhist friend or whatever it is, which does happen an awful lot, you know, when people become friends, they start talking freely to each other. What often comes to light is that I can go so far in accepting something which is being said because I'm adjusting the language to suit the language which is coming from my friend, okay? But so often what happens is that you learn something about what they're saying, but you also deepen in appreciation of what you're saying. I can't give you a good example of that particularly, but maybe the person of Jesus in Islam is as good a one as you can come up with. There's no way that a Muslim interpretation of Jesus as the prophet of Islam is going to be acceptable as such to a Christian who's got a very different sort of Christology in play there. But agreement and disagreement is not actually what this is about. I learn something about why this person can think in these terms, and I can also affirm something of the integrity with which that language is spoken. And my appreciation, therefore, for this person increases. And then I go away and I don't just say, well, I'm glad I'm not a Muslim, and poor old chap, he's got it completely wrong or something, and thank God I'm steeped in my Christological orthodoxy and I know exactly what the answer is. No, in a way which is quite difficult to put into words, you come away with a sense, I know where this is coming from, and I know it's not totally removed from the sort of world which I'm involved in. And with any luck, if I've got the time and the patience, I go away and I say, there's something I need to learn a little bit more about this tradition. I think all you can come up with in the end is a sense of how different worlds both integrate with each other, and very often that's the case with traditions such as Judaism, Christianity and Islam, okay, where there is a shared history, where you appreciate the specificity of a tradition and yet its continuities with other histories. Okay. But at the end of it all, you're really talking less about histories than you are about people who are trying to understand their own histories and how they might fit together or not fit together.
You mentioned there the shared history of what are called the Abrahamic faith, Judaism, Christianity and Islam. But your specialism really is on the Eastern traditions of Hinduism and Buddhism. Firstly, where did your interest in those two religions come from?
I think the easy answer to that is that it's the one thing I felt I wanted to do as a Jesuit that wasn't being given to me on a plate. I could have done some specialist studies in a number of different disciplines, which I was interested in, which would have been scripture study, as far as I was concerned. And I was also interested in early church history, patristics. So those are the things which got me going. I then came to the conclusion, well, there are other people doing this. And the one thing that at this time is not really being looked at really substantially is things which are really very, very much every day for anybody that's practicing a faith, namely religious practice itself, prayer. So prayer, meditation, liturgy, all of those things, the way in which religious belief is actually instantiated in practice itself. That was the sort of thing I was interested in. And I don't know quite how it really happened. Possibly that in the time when I was sort of pondering what should I do when I grow up as a Jesuit, what can I contribute? I thought, well, nobody's really doing anything on other religions. And specifically, nobody's doing anything about the interface between Christian prayer and Buddhist meditation or Hindu meditation or yoga or anything like that. There's a lot of material around, But there was nothing that was going on, as I could see it at the time, which really focused on some of these theological questions, which were arising from the interaction of what we now call the dialogue of religious experience. Okay, so that's how I got into it. And at first, I wasn't quite sure whether I would do something on Islam or something on Buddhism, because I was actually quite interested in Islam as the third of the Abrahamic traditions. You know, what's going on here? What's the history of Christianity and Judaism suddenly morphing into this tradition? You know, how does that all fit together? So that was one set of questions, which was more theoretical for me. And I didn't really want to go in that direction. And I just discovered that Buddhism was probably the one I knew least about and therefore might be more interesting. So that's how I got into that. And it was the dialogue of religious experience. That's how I got into it.
Mm.
But once you've done a little bit on one tradition, you begin to realize, oh, hang on, this is a great world I'm opening up. So it's a... bore you with the story, but I did start thinking I would do a particular course in London on just study of religions, Buddhism specifically. And then I realized, hang on, you can't study Buddhism without studying the religions of India, and you can't study the religions of India without knowing the languages. So I got into Sanskrit and then Pali and all sorts of things like that, and became completely immersed, you know, in stuff which I never expected to.
And then you're totally
to
down
take
it all.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right.
The Abrahamic faiths have sort of a shared history, shared understanding that you sort of mentioned. You know, they are revealed religions, whereas the Eastern traditions are very different. And so, in the sense of religious dialogue, it's easy to see how Jews, Christians, Muslims can talk together because there's sort of a shared history at least, but also a shared specific, you know, monotheistic theology that they can all share. But then when you start to look at dialogue with the Eastern traditions, at least at face value, they are quite different.
Mm-hmm.
What's that encounter between those two faiths? And what I appreciate, this is a very broad question, but what's the sort of encounter there, and what are sort of the things that you've found in how they engage with each other, and what they can learn from one another?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm never quite sure whether there is such a great division between the Abrahamic theistic traditions and the theistic traditions of India, because if you look at the Vedas, which is where, of course, I started, you sort of move back into the Vedic traditions, you've got all of these incredible stories, you know, that there are narratives running right through the Vedic and Indian theistic traditions. Okay, so the world of the Puranas, the ancient stories about the gods, okay, really begins to emerge, you know, beginning of the Christian era, or perhaps rather later than that. And the early traditions, the Vedic traditions, are, of course, 1500 BCE. Those are pretty ancient. But you still have the idea that here are the stories of the gods which are bound up with the story of human beings. And I suppose the big difference is that in the ancient Hindu traditions, you do get the idea that there are different, shall we say, modes of existence, and that includes human beings, animals, people in the spiritual worlds of some kind, plus different levels of the gods. You know, so there's a cosmology at work there. That's the sort of background against which you're working.
Platonic, really, in the sort of sense. It's quite Platonic, really, in the sense of that those sort of levels of existence.
Yes, 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 and that's probably a good way of trying to bring the two sides, as it were, into a correlation. You need something probably like that. But what I've always found fascinating is that from the Vedic traditions, you get philosophical questions, or theological, philosophical questions arising, you know. And there's wonderful hymns towards the end of the Vedic period when the question arises, well, okay, so we've got all these gods. So where do they come from? What do they represent? These are stories about, you know, cosmogonies, about the world itself and how the world is brought into being. Great stuff. But is there a single God? And does that God, this wonderful line at the end of one of the hymns, does this one, big O, does this one principle, this one, does this one know? And then there's a little phrase, you know, or perhaps that one does not know. And you get this sort of agnosticism. And that's really the beginning of the philosophical speculation, which you get in the Upanishads. And of course, it's out of that tradition, the Upanishads, reacting against that, that Buddhism emerges with that question, you know, searching for truth, searching for wisdom, searching for enlightenment. And that, of course, is the link between what I was starting with, religious experience. What is it that actually allows us as human beings to enter into the mystery of the divine? Well, it's practice, and that practice is instantiated very much in the experience of the Buddha, who is the one who is searching for enlightenment. Now, what that's saying is you can't really understand Buddhism without setting it in that very sketchily outlined movement from the Vedas to the Upanishads, Bhagavad Gita and whatever, which I was just hinting at there. It's a whole world of in many ways, I think, awkwardly integrated ideas. And that's the beauty, in many ways, the infuriating beauty of Hinduism. As soon as you've said one thing about it, you have to sort of balance it with something else. And of course, the fact is that there's many different strands, many different traditions at work in Hinduism, all the way from, you know, the classical orthodox Veda, which is still very much at the heart of the whole tradition, philosophical side, very practical side, and then you also you've got this proliferation of bhakti cults, you know, devotional cults. I think you can find quite interesting parallels between the religious practices of Hinduism, if you understand Hinduism in terms of practices which instantiate, come out of certain beliefs. You can find parallels between those and what you find in certainly the Catholic Christian tradition, where you've got strong emphasis on liturgy, you've got strong emphasis on devotion, but you've also got a mystical tradition. All of those are there. So once you get into the sort of, well, what I was talking about earlier, is the questions which people are asking, and also about how you try and give some sort of flesh to those questions in terms of practice, then parallels begin to open up. Big differences, of course. And that's the whole point, that you start with these parallels, you start with the continuities, and then you begin to realize, not quite as simple as I thought it was. And then it gets interesting, because you begin to move from the assurance which says, oh, I know what this tradition is about because I've got this little link. And then you say, that doesn't quite work. There's something more at stake here. And then there's the whole question of how do I find the analogies which really work? Are there deep-lying metaphors at work in different traditions from which we can learn? For example, if you take the metaphor of sacrifice, sacrifice is there in all different traditions. Are they all the same thing? Are they all talking about the same thing? Well, in some ways they are. But in another way, no, they're dealing with different perspectives on life. So that's when you find that, you know, the ancient sacrifices in the temple in Jerusalem, when you read the Old Testament, you think, well, that's rather different from what you find in Vedic sacrificial tradition, where, yeah, okay, so there might be a blood sacrifice, but it's more likely to be the pouring of seeds, of grain into a sacred fire. And they represent really rather different perspectives. But nevertheless, they can be held together. So you can have a conversation about things like that, even though at the end of it all you think, well, once again, yes, I can see something which is opening up a common point. And there are other times when you think, no, that's not a helpful perspective here.
Yeah, I think, the sacrifice one I find fascinating because it is so prevalent throughout all those different faith groups. And I feel like they are all sort of communicating at their core, that core idea of giving back to God or gods. Mm. And that sort of engagement with God in a certain level that is not transactional, but it's engaging with back to God in a way that God has engaged with you by giving life however the tradition views it. And it's so widespread, and all of the religions are coming to it, that you do feel like there is some sort of like eternal truth at the core of that, which human experience has brought to bear. And I don't think, you know, there's much relationship between those people who were sacrificing in the early temple in Jerusalem and those that were sacrificing in northern India.
Mm.
Yet still there's a sort of human experience which is trying to find a way of expressing itself, which ultimately is quite similar.
Yes.
And so in that sort of relationship, you can learn from the other's experience, learn from the other's practices to sort of reflect your own and gain a deeper understanding about your own beliefs, even though sort of, as you say, on that surface level, it's quite different.
Yes. Yes. And then you find, for example, that when you read the Gospels, and we can talk about, you know, Christ's sacrifice of himself on the cross, so that is obviously an important theme in some aspects of Christian theology, but what Jesus is also doing is talking about the real sacrifice, which is the contrite heart, which is offered to God, which in some ways is precisely what he's doing in offering himself to the Father, so that the Father and the Son, you know, become one in the acceptance, the giving and the acceptance of each other in this intimacy of love. So this is saying something about the way in which human beings are made. Christians would say in the image of Christ, all right? Therefore, they enter into this relationship of Father and Son, the Trinitarian God. We live in the Spirit. We enter into this mystery of God's love. Now, that is coming out of the Jewish sacrificial tradition, and it's a way of trying to refigure it, and that's what Christ does. Okay, the sacrifice I want is that of the humble, contrite heart, all of that stuff. Okay. Then you think to yourself, well, that's miles away from what you get in the Vedic tradition, but actually there's something really rather interesting goes on there, where they talk about the sacrifice of the Atman, okay, the person, and there's this image of the creation as the self-sacrifice of God, the one principle sacrifices itself and therefore makes itself present in the world. So that when human beings and the gods and the spirits and whatever are all integrated together in this great sacrificial ritual, which has its different forms everywhere, okay, they're actually doing something really really quite similar to what you find at a deep level in Christian faith. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's self-making, it's soul-making. That's something that I find, as soon as you touch on something like that, you find in different ways, everybody can sort of nod and say, yeah, this lovely Ramadan at the moment, you know, Muslims are practicing Ramadan, which is, of course, a long daily fast in which you get to the end, and there each day you have this iftar, the breaking of the fast, and you really appreciate what you've given up and therefore what you've got, and you really have a wonderful meal, which isn't just appreciating the food which is given to you, which tastes wonderful. I mean, I've done it. You taste that date and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's appreciating community, and it's also appreciating what God does for us in terms of making us more conscious of everything that God has given, which is this lovely word, taqwa, which I think is so, so beautiful. You know, God consciousness, becoming aware that at the heart of our humanity is a consciousness, an awareness of the God who has chosen us, led us, and expects us to respond by behaving in a certain way, reciting the words of the Quran. There was a lovely man, I always think of this, this was an imam talking to a little group of us, and I was trying to get out of him, what happens when you recite the words of the Quran? I said, because that's building up taqwa. And I said, well, it sounds to me as if what they're doing is simply using the words of the Quran in order to pray. What does that do? And he said, oh, yes, he said, God loves to hear God's words. And I thought the most beautiful idea. God loves to hear God's words. And that's what we're here for. For a Muslim, we're here in order to praise God, to use the words that God has given us in order to praise God. And there's more to it than that, obviously. But that's my point, that you listen to somebody talking and you say, I can get hold of that. I can respond to that. I would put it rather differently, and I would say there's more to be said. You know, for example, so as a good Christian, I'm here to do more than just praise God. I'm here to thank God. But I'm here also to act in a prophetic way, to speak the words of God. Muslim would probably agree with that, in order to make this world a better place. Mm. But little weird things like that, you know, begin to open up this sense that, yeah, we are very different human beings. We do ask very different questions. But sometimes we can pick up little resonances. Sometimes they are quite small ones. If you go to a certain depth, you say, oh, yeah, that really touches. It's very difficult to put your finger exactly on what it is. Mm. But taqwa, God consciousness, it suddenly becomes alive. And in Islam, in Buddhism, you'd have the same sort of sense of enlightenment. What is enlightenment in Buddhism? That's a big question. But in some ways, it's not that great explosion which suddenly says, boing, you know, now I've got it, now I understand it. It's a great sort of mystical vision of things. It's just this growing sense, I understand who I am and what this extraordinary reality, which is sentient life, you know, the life of sentient beings, it suddenly comes alive for you. Different language, it's not taqwa, but there's something which links them together.
These religions all talk similarly about nothingness in a way, or like the inexpressibility of God. There's sort of that idea that, you know, the more you go into it, the more it's that unknowing. Mm. And with similar with the Tapua and the Enlightenment and developing God consciousness, there are all these sort of ideas. Is there sort of that? Is the idea then behind religious dialogue, interreligious relationships, the idea that there is a kernel of truth which is inexpressible, that we can't fully reach, and that these religious faiths have grown out of that, of trying to comprehend that, and now we can just sort of engage with one another in that shared unknowing of God.
I suppose all religious traditions would say that at some level they have an insight to share into the, let's simply call it, the human condition or the meaning of life. And sometimes that's cashed out in strongly theistic terms. So Christianity is through and through a theistic tradition.
Yeah.
So we are convinced of the truth, which I suppose it isn't directly the Christian tradition, but it is going right back to the origins of Christian reflection on the nature of God, namely Moses and the burning bush. You know, that is, you know, the classical image of a human being faced with the mystery of God, you know, where God has a name, and Moses says to God, "Well, come on, you know, I'm going to go back to these people. What are you saying? And you get this really rather obscure, untranslatable, "I am who I am," or whatever, however you translate it. The translation is not the important thing. It is the fact that God speaks. First of all, God calls Moses. You know, he's attracted, and then he finds that he's being called into this relationship. And that is somehow emblematic of what all Jews, all Christians, and in their own way, all Muslims follow out, that there is a God that is beyond name, to whom we give all sorts of names, but they're always regarded as, contingent names which are taken from the tradition, which are called forth by Moses' question, "Who shall I say? Who shall I say is called?" But it's the call which is important. So you get, for example, that wonderful experience of Elijah the prophet, you know, who's suddenly decided he doesn't really want to do this at all. He doesn't know what on earth's going on. And he ends up in that cave, and all sorts of portents come crashing past. And at the end of it, you have this still small voice. Again, it's another little idea which is so untranslatable, but just a reminder that all of the ways in which we think God can be somehow named are inadequate. And what God does is to come, still small voice, the sound of a silent breeze or whatever it is. It's simply trying to get at the incomprehensibility of God, the eternal, which yet has many names. You know, from Muslims, and the 99 names of God, you know, and the 100th is kept by the camel or something like that, you know. Wonderful idea. So you have this curious but really rather wonderful dialectic that goes on between the incomprehensibility of God, the conviction we have that whatever you say is only a name, and yet this is a God who enters deeply into our lives, not a calling from afar, but somehow just making God's self present in ways which are very, very difficult to encapsulate at all. And I think that sort of mystical way of talking is trying to get at, very simply, the sense of being led, being called, reaching out, and going on reaching out even though you know that all you can ever do is just touch into the eternal, and that somehow that's enough. My favorite mystical theologian from the early church is Gregory of Nyssa, and he has this lovely idea in the Life of Moses where he says that the perfection of humanity is in its very reaching out, the perfection of humanity. In other words, it doesn't matter whether you're grabbing something. That's not the point. You know, it's the reaching. The epectasis is the word in the Greek. And it's there in Paul. You know, I am always striving ahead, always reaching out. And I think the point that's being made is that if we reach out into this eternal, we will find that the eternal somehow reaches out to us, because there is that in us which always desires a fullness. And this God, who is fullness, is always seeking us in some way. Now that's typically, not perhaps well expressed there, something which you get in Judaism. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all have these mystical traditions. And I had wonderful experiences with Sufi communities a few years ago. And what I will always remember was the dhikr, the prayer, where there's just this chant that goes on. And at certain points, the chant changes. And you realize that what's being expressed as the chant goes on is not this sort of mesmerizing repetition, which is supposed to be eternal. No, paradoxically, the eternal repetition is actually a changing repetition. There's always something that comes back in order to show that it never remains the same. God is unchanging. That's one of the sort of classics of Christian theology. But paradoxically, it's a God who is always seeking to change us. Perhaps that's the point. Perhaps that's the point. God is unchanging, but that does not mean that God is not seeking always to bring about growth and transformation and change in us. Anyway, that's a quick thought.
Yeah. Yeah, quick thought for the morning. We're almost out of time, Father. Time flies when you have such a fantastic conversation. But for those religiously inclined, if let's call them, that are listening, what sort of, recommendations or would you suggest, or suggestions for them, on how to engage with the people who you first mentioned at the start of this conversation, the people of other faiths? And how do we sort of build these dialogical situations that we've been talking about this morning, this afternoon, midday, throughout our conversation?
It's a good question. It's not an easy question to answer because it is quite a daunting prospect to go and talk to somebody that is a stranger. You know, and of course, people who belong to other religious traditions are strangers. We find it very difficult as Christians of a particular denomination to go and talk to the other church round the corner. Catholics do not talk to strict evangelicals. We're just completely different worlds. Well, no, we're not. Let's get over that one. There are things which we share in common, and there are things which we need to talk to each other about. Okay, that's the cause of ecumenism. The cause of interreligious dialogue, as I say right at the beginning, has got an ethical, moral dimension to it. You know, we are responsible as people of faith for our world, and therefore we need to at least learn about other traditions. And I would simply say, if you're living in a particular area, you know, not a bad idea to try and find a place of worship which may bring together, will bring together, people from Muslim community or Buddhist community or whatever. I've always found, but then I've been a professional in this for years and years, so I've had a lot of experience. If you cross over the threshold, it is always quite daunting to cross over a threshold into another place of worship, because you don't really know what you're going to get. Mm. And you also find that it is strange, and you have to, you know, sensitize yourself to what's going on there. Okay, it takes a bit of an effort to do it, but I've always found there's always a welcome. Mm. I've never found in any of these places people looking at you suspiciously, who the hell are you? You know, you do get a little bit of that once you're inside, and then people relax a little bit, and they might ask a question, but by and large, most people are only too delighted that they've got a stranger in their midst. Now, of course, go back to writing, you know, your original question. Conversion? Yeah. There will be efforts made to convert you, or to say, well, you've really got it wrong. Well, what are you doing here? But conversations grow.
Yeah.
And I go back to that point about host and guest, you know. As Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, or whatever, we exist in two modes. One as host, one as guest. One as teacher, one as learner. And there are things to be learned from living in those two modes. And these days, I think we need to learn how to be guests in somebody else's space. And I think it's probably one of the imperatives of contemporary living. Learning how to be a host, relatively easy. I'm in charge. You come to me. Okay, fine. What about being a guest in somebody else's space, where we have to stop doing the teaching and we have to recognize that there is something to be learnt? And not just learnt about this particular community or what so-and-so is saying, but what otherness, what I don't really understand, is still saying to me. And that's something to do with the mystery of God. Now, that's an act of faith, to go into some other place and say, the mystery of God can be revealed to me in this place. But I profoundly believe that it is the case, that if you honestly go into another place with that integrity which says, I still have something to learn, despite the fact that I am convinced that my tradition teaches me truth, okay, but there can still be elements of that truth which I don't fully understand. This is God's world, and God has a purpose, it seems to me, in giving us a variety of different religious traditions. They're there for a purpose, and they're there for a purpose of helping me to deepen my own faith, my own understanding of the impenetrable mystery of God.
It's probably a good place to leave it.
Well, we can go on if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you sort of say, just to sort of wrap it up, I think, as you say, there's a great sort of humility required to go in as a guest. Mm. And to go in and say, you know, I don't have the answers, all the answers, as much as I would like to. There is something to be learned from engaging with another faith.
Can be very exciting. Can be quite threatening.
Yeah.
But it can be very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you're made to think. Yeah. And you're made to feel differently also.
Yeah.
You know, the best prayer is always the affective prayer. When you move from you know, the statement about what you know to be true to something which really affects you, which enters into the heart. Okay, and that very often is what happens when you're in a place of worship. There's that sort of tentativeness of, oh my God, you know, this stomach is churning a little bit. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen here. And then it's settled. And when it's settled, you say, I can't quite put my finger on it. I can't put it into the cognitive side, but I can feel it. Mm. It touches me affectively. And I find great consolation in the fact that actually there's something amazingly warm and vibrant and consoling, you know, in this place with these people.
Well, Father Michael, I think, as I mentioned, that's probably a good place to leave things. I'd just like to say again, thank you very much for having me in to talk with you. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I think we've touched upon a few good topics there that hopefully will give the listeners a bit of food for thought. And I'll put links to your copious numbers of books out there and articles, so people, if they want to delve deeper into the world of Father Michael Barnes, they're able to do so.
Thank you. Thank you, Jack. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and thank you, everyone, for listening.